Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. I'm so glad that you're with me today for this journey of exploring, understanding, explaining, and defending our Catholic faith. What I'm doing right now is I'm going through the five minimal facts argument that's popularized by one of my professors, Dr. Gary Habermas, where the vast majority of scholars all around the world for decades have been granting these five historical facts surrounding Easter. Number one, the death of Jesus by crucifixion. Number two, the empty tomb being found on Easter Sunday morning. The third one is that Jesus' disciples believed he rose from the dead and appeared to them physically alive after his crucifixion, death, and burial. And so this is really the evidence of appearances. We started talking about this in the last episode. The fourth fact is that Paul became who he was. He was the Rabbi Saul. He became the Apostle Paul. He was a persecutor of the church. Went from that to being its biggest evangelist. Something has to explain that. We think it was the resurrection. And the fifth fact that most scholars agree upon, will grant you from a historical point of view, is that Jesus' skeptical relative, James, not only became a believer in Jesus, he wasn't prior to the resurrection, he becomes a believer in Jesus after Easter, becomes the Bishop of Jerusalem and a martyr for the faith. So the conversions of Paul and James, both skeptics themselves, are pretty important here. So let's go back to, so we were on the third fact, the appearances of Christ post-Easter. And we talked about a lot of different things in the last episode. If you missed it, you can certainly check the podcast on relevantradio.com and also through the app. And we talked about how there's excellent evidence, eyewitness testimony for the resurrection appearances of Jesus. And there's something else I wanted to say about this, that all of the apostles and so many more disciples were willing to risk their lives, and in fact did pay for with their lives in many cases for their belief in Easter. We know that. We look at the Gospels. Prior to the death of Jesus, when he was arrested, most everyone deserted him, ran away. They were terrified that they'd be next to be put on trial. The only one that was faithful, of course, was John the Apostle, and some of the women as well, including the mother of Jesus being at the foot of the cross. But why is it that the disciples went from running away in fear to then boldly going where no one has gone before, in a certain sense, to steal a line from Star Trek, to lead the greatest evangelization movement in history, only days later, by boldly preaching the fact that Jesus was resurrected, physically alive from death? And all we need to do, really, is pick up the Acts of the Apostles, and we can see how much St. Paul suffered for the resurrection. We see how much St. Peter suffered, and so many more. Okay, take a look at Acts chapter 4. Peter and John, they're both arrested. They're thrown into prison. In the very next chapter, in chapter 5 of the Acts of the Apostles, they're arrested, imprisoned, they're flogged. And then in chapter 12, we talk about James, a different James. He's the brother of John, the sons of thunder, Boanerges, as Jesus called them. They are James is killed. Peter is thrown into prison once more. So we know that eventually Peter was crucified upside down for his faith. He who once ran away from the cross embraced it himself in the end. The church father Origen wrote about this in great detail. And James, we spoke about James just a couple of minutes ago, the different James who was known as, in the New Testament, the brother of the Lord. He was not another son of Mary, but he was, I think, a relative of Jesus. Josephus, who's a great Jewish historian of the times, he said that in the year AD 60 or thereabouts, the Jewish Sanhedrin, and that's the very group of religious leaders that condemned Jesus to death, handed him over to the Romans, they conducted another kangaroo trial of sorts and illegally had James stoned to death. So when we look at all the suffering post-Easter that the apostles and so many others endured for the sake of the gospel, for the message of the resurrection, we have to remember this one thing. No one will die for something that they know for sure is not true. Now, we will certainly grant that people will die for something that they think is true, something that they sincerely believe is true. Suicide bombers immediately come to mind. But here's the thing. The disciples were certainly in a position to know whether or not Jesus had really appeared to them bodily resurrected from the dead or not, as they claimed. Now don't forget, if they were trying to invent their own religion or concoct a story about Jesus being the Messiah, even though they know full well he's not, that he's still in the tomb, there's so many other ways they could have gone. If they were making this up, they could have said, we saw a vision of Jesus, or we had a dream. I had a dream. Dreams and visions are stock and trade in the Bible. In the Old Testament, they're all over the place, very much accepted in Jewish circles. They could have gone that route, but that's not what they said. They really went the hard way. They claimed resurrection, physical, bodily resurrection, leaving an empty tomb behind. That is a lot more difficult to prove. And so if they really had, for example, that we looked at in an earlier episode at the stolen body theory, it doesn't make any sense. And this is one argument that the religious authorities put forward as saying, hey, this is what really happened on Easter. The disciples stole the body. Well, if they really had Jesus' body in the trunk of a car somewhere, why are they going out and getting themselves killed for saying that he's physically risen from the dead? It doesn't make any sense. It's not like there was anything in this humanly speaking for them. There were no Mediterranean mansions along the coastline waiting the apostles. No, it was only almost certain death. Only one of the apostles was not martyred, and that was, of course, John. He lived to a relatively ripe old age, but he certainly had his share of sufferings as well, being imprisoned on the island of Patmos, where most people think he wrote the book of Revelation from there. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. All right, let's move on now from the resurrection appearances. We're going to deal with some objections, by the way, to the appearances, to a lot of the other stuff that we've been talking about. We'll deal with all the objections at the end, but let's go now to the fourth of the minimal historical facts here, and that is the church persecutor, who was known as Saul the Pharisee, converted to the faith, became Paul the Apostle, and was martyred for his belief in the risen Jesus. Okay, this is an unimpeachable historical fact. This is an unimpeachable historical fact. Nobody doubts the conversion of Saul to Paul. Now, the question is, what caused him to do this? What caused his preaching to be so successful? Probably the best explanation is the one that he himself gives. I mean, the man's own opinion has to count for something, right? He says it happened because Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Now, at this point, Jesus was already in heaven. He had already ascended into heaven. So he appeared to Paul in a different way than he did to the other apostles. And this is mentioned in the Corinthian Creed. We talked about this in the last episode. Paul says, last of all, abnormally born, he says, he appeared also to me. And so if you look at the Acts of the Apostles, you can read about all of the things he did prior to getting to know Jesus personally. He was persecuting the early church. He was aiding and abetting the death of the first believers, some of them. We can read this in the Acts of the Apostles. Look at Acts chapter 7, verse 58, Acts chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, and then in Acts chapter 9, to the first few verses of that chapter as well, 1 through 19. Also, he talks about his former life in Acts 22, verses 3 to 16, and Acts 26, verses 9 to 23. And we know that Paul's conversion was so important to him that he talked about this, and Luke wrote about this at Paul's behest. Of course, St. Luke wrote not only the Gospel of Luke, but the Acts of the Apostles. He was a traveling companion of St. Paul. He talks about his conversion three different times in the same book, and he probably talked about it hundreds, if not thousands, of times during his preaching experiences because it was so meaningful to him. Now, when you're writing a book in the ancient world, you're using papyrus, you don't want to waste it. Every word matters. You only have so much space. It's not like a modern-day computer program where you can just delete everything and there's this infinite sheet that you can just keep writing and writing. No, well, and every time he talks about it, every one of those three occurrences in the book of Acts, he hits on a different angle, something about it that's important for his particular audience. And we can do that too. When we talk about our own stories, when we share our own experiences with Jesus Christ, with our friends, family, coworkers, people that we're trying to bring to Jesus, we can highlight aspects of our journey that might resonate really well with the other person. But the question still has to be asked, what was it that changed Paul's mind? Well, Jesus appeared to him. And my friend Greg Manette in his book, The Wrong Jesus, he has a rather striking illustration. He says, what would it have taken for Osama bin Laden to change his mind, become a believer in Jesus Christ, and then start running a school for girls in Afghanistan? Now, it would have to be something incredibly life-changing to make somebody do a 180 like that. Well, Paul says it was because Jesus, risen from the dead, now glorified in heaven, had appeared to him. Now, this is great historical evidence, the conversion of Paul, because we have a hostile source here. This is enemy attestation. This is somebody who was an enemy of the early Christian movement, now becoming a propagator of the message. Also, don't forget, eyewitness testimony comes into play as well, because Paul claims to have encountered Jesus personally. So we have a firsthand account from one of the eyewitnesses in the letters of St. Paul. All right, now let's look at the fifth historical fact, the minimal facts argument popularized by Gary Habermas. These are five facts that virtually all scholars around the world will grant, no matter what they believe, whether they're atheists, whether they belong to another faith, whether they're Christians. Some of them are. Some of them do believe in Jesus. Doesn't matter. This is just from a historical point of view. They will grant you these five minimal facts. All right. James, who was known in the New Testament as the brother of the Lord, again, not a son of Mary, did not believe in Jesus prior to the resurrection, does become a believer afterwards. And he's mentioned in this Corinthian creed. Paul writes, he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. All right. So in the New Testament, a lot of Jesus' relatives at some points actually thought he was out of his mind. Now we see this, for example, in Mark chapter 3. I'm just going to read this passage to you. In Mark chapter 3, verse 31 and following, Mark writes, and his mother and his brethren came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting about him, and they said to him, your mother and your brethren are outside asking for you. And he replied, who are my mother and my brethren? And looking around on those who sat about him, he said, here are my mother and my brethren. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Now, he wasn't denigrating, by the way, when Jesus said this, his mother, not at all. In fact, she was the preeminent doer of the will of God. And so we see this, of course, in the Annunciation, be it done unto me according to thy word. So let's move on a little bit. Now, here's what Mark writes. He says, he went away from there and came to his own country. And this is Jesus, of course. And his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were astonished, saying, where did this man get all this? What is the wisdom given to him? What mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joses, and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, and among his own kin, and in his own house. And he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people, and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went about among the villages teaching. Okay, so in that passage, and by the way, you might be asking, well, who are these sisters of Jesus? Well, again, they are not daughters of Mary. These brethren of Jesus are not other sons of Mary, okay? We'll talk about that in a future episode. I do want to talk about James later on in more detail, who he was, and we'll deal with who these quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus are, but rest assured that they are not other children of Mary. Always have to have this disclaimer, but I do want to suggest here from this passage that James did not exactly buy into Jesus being the Messiah at this point. And Jesus even acknowledges this in his own comment. A prophet is not without honor except among his own kin, his own relatives. All right, now I want to flip to another passage here. I want to look at the Gospel of John. In John chapter 7, we read this in the first few verses, verses 1 to 10 of John 7. John writes, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. So his brethren said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may see the works you are doing. For no man works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For even his brethren did not believe in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. Go to the feast yourselves. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." So saying, he remained in Galilee. But after his brethren had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. Okay, so there you have in that passage a bit of a dispute between Jesus and some of his relatives, who we would be assuming included James, who didn't buy into him at that point. Okay, now let's fast forward a little bit to the Acts of the Apostles. Now we see this in Acts chapter 1. Now, this is right after Jesus ascends into heaven. Let's look at Acts chapter 1, starting with verse 12. It says, "Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away. And when they had entered, they went up to the upper room where they were staying, Peter and John and James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus and Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James. All these with one accord devoted themselves to prayer, together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brethren." Okay, so there are a lot of James, I know, floating around. So we'd have to think that the James that eventually became the Bishop of Jerusalem and a martyr was among these brethren of the Lord. Again, not other sons of Mary that were there in the upper room with her and with the apostles. Now we do know, of course, we looked at this in the last episode. So if you want to read this again, just go to Galatians chapter 1. We know that James was in fact a leader post-Easter in the Jerusalem church. Galatians 1:19, you can look at chapter 2, verse 9 and verse 12. We see it later on in Acts chapter 12, verse 17, Acts chapter 15, verse 13. Because James, as the bishop of Jerusalem, as it were, he kind of is the host for the first council of the Catholic Church. Now, we know about Vatican II, of course, our latest council, which took place in the 20th century. But the very first one was really the Council of Jerusalem, which is narrated in Acts chapter 15. Of course, Peter, the first pope, is there, but James is kind of the host as the bishop of Jerusalem. We do know also in Acts chapter 21, verse 18, St. Paul, he checks in with James from time to time, and Peter. He always wanted to make sure that he was on the right track, showing accountability there to the other apostles. Acts 21, 18 is a good example of that. So we see that this transformation of James, how does he go from skeptic prior to Easter to not only a believer in Jesus as Messiah, his resurrection, he becomes an apostle, he becomes, in fact, the Bishop of Jerusalem, a martyr and a witness to the faith. And the word witness, one of the meanings of the word witness is martyr. So there you have it. And all of this is really kind of in the background of this Corinthian creed in 1 Corinthians 15:7, when Paul says he appeared to James after the resurrection. So the best explanation for the conversion of James has to be the resurrection of Jesus. The same is with Paul and his conversion. So those are the five minimal facts. I'm going to add a bonus fact for you. This isn't necessarily one of Habermas's five facts, but I'm going to throw it in because I also think it's really powerful. And it's this: the fact that the testimony of women is really, really key in establishing the resurrection. I'll tell you why this is important. That might not jump out at you initially, but women as eyewitnesses of the risen Christ, it's crucial. If the apostles had fabricated the Easter account of Jesus' resurrection from the dead, they wouldn't have done this. If they were inventing a story, they would not have done this, because each of the four Gospels say that women were the first to discover the empty tomb of Christ and to encounter him in his resurrected state. In fact, every one of the four Gospels says that Mary Magdalene was the very first person to inform the disciples that Jesus was alive. And that's why Mary Magdalene is called the apostle to the apostles. And why are we sure that things actually happened this way? Well, unfortunately, at that time in the first century, women were not considered reliable witnesses in Judaism at the time of Jesus. Consider these quotes. Now, these are some actual quotes from the rabbis around this time. This is from the Jewish Talmud, okay? Here's a quote. "Sooner let the words of the law be burned than delivered into the hands of women." Ouch. That wow. And that's right from the rabbis in the Talmud. And here's another one. This is also from the Talmud. "Any evidence which a woman gives is not valid to offer." So this would be testimony in a court of law, that sort of thing. Goes on to say, "This is equivalent to saying that one who is rabbinically accounted to be a robber is qualified to give the same evidence as a woman." End of quote. And that's also from the Talmud. So basically, it's saying that a woman's testimony is on the same level as a convicted criminal. Josephus, the great Jewish historian of the times, says this, "Let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex, since it is probable that they may not speak truth, either out of hope of gain or fear of punishment." End of quote. So obviously there's a tremendous amount of unjust bias in these statements, but the reason why I bring this up is because there's no way, again, if the apostles were inventing a story, there is no way they would say that women were the first to encounter the risen Christ. If you're trying to convince your fellow Jews that Jesus is the Messiah risen from the dead, you would not say that women were the ones to discover the empty tomb and encounter Jesus first. You would say it happened to Peter, or you'd have Joseph of Arimathea discovering the empty tomb, that sort of thing. And in fact, it's also interesting to know, it's kind of instructive on this level, that Rabbi Saul, who became the Apostle Paul, when he lists resurrection appearances in the Corinthian Creed, he doesn't mention the women. And maybe that's because he's sensitive to this. He doesn't want to offend his fellow Jewish scholars. I don't know. He certainly knows of this tradition, but maybe he just decided not to use it. And so unfortunately, that was the situation in the first century world. And thankfully, the Catholic Church has done so much to promote the dignity of women since then. It's safe to say, though, that if the apostles wanted to convince fellow Jews Jesus is the Messiah, they wouldn't have started with this unless they had to. The reason why they said this, that Mary Magdalene was the first, and other women were there too, is because that's the way it actually happened. Again, this is the criterion of embarrassment. This is a potentially embarrassing detail. You just simply wouldn't put it in there. It doesn't strengthen your case unless it actually happened. And by the way, this sheds a lot of light on the gospel passages that tell us that when Mary Magdalene initially went to the apostles saying that Jesus was alive, they thought it was a tall tale. Let's look at Mark's gospel in Mark chapter 16, verses 9 to 11. It says, "Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it." And I think the reason why they wouldn't believe it was simply because she was a woman, and that's a sad truth. But again, the fact that this gets into the story, they didn't try to embellish things. They didn't try to fix it up to make it look good. They told it the way it was. So I think there's a lot of reasons to trust the resurrection accounts here. So whatever explanation that you try to come up with to try to explain our minimal facts that we've talked about here, your explanation has to account for all of these facts, and it's got to do so more persuasively than any alternative arguments. So the only explanation that really accounts for all of these minimal facts is really that Jesus was resurrected from the dead on Easter Sunday. It's the only one that makes sense of all the data that we have. So this is a really powerful argument when taken together to try to convince skeptics. You know, I'm not a huge poetry guy, but I've always been struck by this one. There's a poem called Seven Stanzas at Easter, written by John Updike. And he originally entered this poem to try to win a contest, and he did, in fact, win. And I think it's just an incredible poem for the Easter season because it emphasizes the bodily, corporeal reality of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is a real historical event, a physical resurrection. It's not a metaphor. There's so many people in our time who want to say, no, it was a spiritual resurrection. No. It was physical. This requires an empty tomb being left behind. Now, this is what St. Paul said, once again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 14. If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. Well, this is how John Updike puts it in his poem, Seven Stanzas at Easter. He writes, make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules reknit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouths and fuddled eyes of the 11 apostles. It was as his flesh, ours. The same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might, new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign, painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back, not paper mache, not a stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if we will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen, spun on a definite loom. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous for our own convenience or our own sense of beauty, lest awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance. What a great poem. Seven Stanzas at Easter by John Updike. You've been listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Thank you so much for joining me. In the next episode, we'll deal with some of the more common objections to the resurrection, such as the apostles were hallucinating, all those ones that you've heard before. We'll deal with it next. Thanks for joining me today on The Faith Explained. I'm your host, Cale Clark. If you missed an episode, you can always catch them in podcast form on the Relevant Radio app. I'll join you in the next one, and I'll be with you later today at 5 p.m. Central right here on Relevant Radio for The Cale Clark Show. Until next time, God bless you.